All right, I'm José de Cal, for those of you who don't know me. And I'm here today to talk a little bit of about F-mod physics, but with atoms, cold atoms, and also dipolar molecules. Right? I prepared this talk to be a semi-tutorial style, right? So people, especially from the more the chemistry side, can see how we treat field body problems. We are all field body physicists, right? Me and the chemistries and so on, but we treat very different systems, right? So I think it is important try to establish a common language. Some of our tools could be useful for their problems and vice versa. Right? So perhaps here we can talk a little bit about these possible connections. And I also want to acknowledge the people that have been working, right? Some of these results are always in linear combination of these people. And our sponsors are mainly the National Science Foundation and the Air Force, especially for the DIBO part of this work. So I thought just for the starter, as a starter, right, to give a, this is my personal view of this field of field body physics, right? In so, how can I put this? Well, this is the kind of things we are looking for, right? We are typically looking, trying to make use of universal properties of the system, right? To determine scaling properties, like how a collision process scale has we changed the scaffolding, right? Has we changed the electric field, right? In particular for dipoles, that's very important. And always in a regime where we have a large A. A here is the scatter length, which I'm not gonna be going into details. What is the scatter length? I'm hoping everyone is a little bit familiar with that. It's just, if you wanna think, is a measure of how strong two particles could interact. Right? The cross section is the scatter length square, for instance, right? And also the fact that we have low temperatures allow us to use simple model for the pairwise interaction. Right? That makes our life much easier than it is for our chemistry. Right? But of course, we pay some price. We need to understand the problem when we actually have a very complicated interaction like a real system. Right? And we are always looking for novel full body states, novel triatomic state, tetratomic states, and so on, even more. Dorta has been working on the mini boson problem with, I think, 20, 30 bosons, and also finding cluster states in that case, right? And we also want to learn how to control losses, whether that's possible or not. One novel state is one that you didn't know about it. Now there's the these fermionic states for when you have two head fermions in a light third particle. Doesn't matter which it is. Right, Dorta has been working on these kind of states. That was just recently, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago that people realized these states. They are very interesting. They are completely universal. In that sense. And there is also.
Let me give one example then, probably of similar how two heavy cesium bosons can be bound by a lithium fermion, light lithium fermion, which that would be the boson equivalent of what Jose was talking about. The two experimental groups are exploring this right now.
So, novel in that sense. We didn't know that they could exist, and they exist in a universal manner. Right? It doesn't matter. If you are talking about nuclear physics or atomic physics, if you have low energy and those particles interact via short range, they should exist. Right. And of course, right, this, I'm not going to be talking about this today, just too much. But maybe later on in the dinner, if you give me some beers, we can talk about it. But that's more, I just want to set up how we see these problems, right? The few by three atoms interacting, four atoms, and so on. And I think that has been a very interesting field, right? In the past few years, right? We were able to understand various signatures related with F-Mod physics, right? Understand how those things extend, has increased the number of particles, again, new family of states. And all of that with a strong support from the experimental side. Experiments have teach us a lot of things, right? And especially in the past 2 years, right? But they offer a very unique condition, which is the ability of control the interaction, control the scattering, right? That's one of the most important things that made the whole difference, right? And okay, this is just emphasize, again, those are a good number of experimental papers. There are more, only experimental papers, far I can tell. Oh no, there's one theoretical there. But now, how do we think these problems? Well, how do we treat a few particle problem? Right. Well, you can look at typical Hamiltonian. Right. Again, some chemistry can complain that there's some terms missing here for non-additive interactions and so on, but we can also include that, right? But we typically look at a problem like this, right? There's a set of interatomic distance and a bunch of angles, right? But we like to rewrite this and think that in a hyperspherical way, right? If you do a transformation to a hyperspherical coordinates, your Hamiltonian is gonna be written in terms of a single length scale, which is the hyperradius, right? And through all the other degrees of freedom in terms of hyperangles, okay? Numerically, you might like this because you don't need to integrate from zero to infinity. You always have a set of compact coordinates. Of course, and the hyperradius, just emphasize, the hyperradius is just the overall size of the system. And of course, the choice of your hyperspherical coordinates is very important. And the ones that we have been using are what people call the democratic angles, hyperangles, right? From Smith, Witten, Johnson, Kupperman, and Aquilanti. All this work comes from chemistry. Right? Those people will study and establish this new coordinate system mainly in chemistry. Right? And one of the reasons they are good is that it helps for you to describe fragmentation channels. Typically, if you pick one set of hyperangles, right, which are not those, it might describe well this kind of process, but it fails in describe a process where this guy is bound. So you have to make rotate your coordinate system, so on. And these ones you don't have to, right? And also symmetrization. Symmetrization is very simplified. It's very simple in this kind of coordinate. So those are the main reasons we choose this kind of coordinates. And then, of course, once you have established your Hamiltonian hyperspherical coordinates, you want to expand. We expand the wave function using this the adiabatic representation. Imagine that R is a slow varying coordinate, and so for that we fix R, and so for the hyperangles, right? Solving this equation. And which turns out is always the toughest part of this approach. Once we have determined effective potential, for instance, we can now, the hyperradial part is always the same. The only thing that changes is the angular part, right? So this is here now just one example, right, of a set of effective potentials, right? You can think in terms of Bohr-Oppenheimer, right? Or they're not different. The difference is that we go beyond Bohr-Oppenheimer approximation. And just to give you a physical picture, right, the channels that are below zero, right, are typically the bound channels, we call 2+1 sometimes, or atom dimer channel. And those are the three-body continuous channels. Right, so three-body recombination is something that comes from here and finish there. But also, you can see all the levels, bound states in these guys, are the ones below the lowest threshold, and all the above, they are going to be resonances, and so on. So we have to solve typically a usual radio equation for two bodies. It's no different than that. Right? That's one of the things we like. So we can interpret physically what is happening in this very complicated system. Doesn't matter how many bodies you have, you always would get something like this. So you can look and stare at the potentials and see bound states and so on. This is just to give a sense, right, of the length scales we work. Right, there's the van der Waal length, typically a few hundred Bohr, temperatures of 100 nanoKelvin. And that's all translate, if you want to solve the Schrödinger equation, we have to solve it to very large distance. It's almost microscopic, if you think. Because the collision energy, the temperature, typically temperatures are very low. Right? So which implies in a very long de Broglie wavelength. Which one? This one? Mainly the collision energy or the energy. Of course, if I'm doing bound state calculations, right, and I know the bounds, I want to calculate this bound state, I don't need to go that far. Everything else is going to fall off exponentially. But scattering, you have to go at a very large distance. Yeah.
Beyond what distance, so is there actual coupling? In other words, if you propagate out some distance, then there are no coupling beyond that. But coupling beyond a certain distance, the propagation may be somewhat trivial. I mean, or is that the case? Or
well,
the
So there are some couplings that go like 1 over r.
Okay.
Right, so they're very long range, too.
Because you have these long range couplings in the three-body system that you propagate at a large distance converge.
In part, that's true, right? Because you have to make sure, right? I don't know how to quantify this right now. Right? I typically I go way beyond the de Broglie wavelengths. That ensures me that I'm going to be in a threshold regime, right? And of course, and typically this regime is the couplings are already negligible.
Right. In terms of your calculations, you spend most of your calculating time in the shorter range region. You know, like I think Garrett was talking about that yesterday. That most of the calculation time is short range, and then very little time is spent going out the long range.
No.
Well,
I think as far as I understand from yesterday is that they use different methods for the short range part and the long range part. Right? And of course, for us, we need to just make sure at large distance. And here we don't switch the method from large r to small r to large r. We always use the same. Right? But most of the time of our calculation is to obtain these potentials. Okay. Once we have the set of potentials, of course, we do the standard scattering calculation. That can also be time demanding, depending on the number of channels you have. But I would say that we roughly take almost the same amount of time to calculate these potentials for each R. Well, you can look to a single potential, right? For me, that's intuitive. I mean, if I see a barrier here, right? I know that this barrier is gonna lead to some change in the dynamic of a reaction process. Yeah, that's what one. Okay, so. In most of the cases, that's not, okay? But that only means that we have to couple a good number of channels here to describe. So, but still, these potentials are still meaningful. I mean, if I pick just one potential here, this is, I single out one potential, which means use that potential to solve this equation, throwing away all the couplings. That typically is not a good approximation, but it is not good in terms of 10%. Sometimes, well, depending on the system, have been treating since they are strong correlated. That would be a horrible approximation. All right. And then we have to include couplings. And these couplings, these couplings are always related with kinetic energy corrections, because you're treating this as this was very slow in comparison to the internal motion, right? But that's not typically the case. Well, these units here.
On the right side, you're saying it's a separation between three bodies, things, and two and one body, things, therefore, binding energy.
Yeah. This energy from zero down here is the binding energy of these diatomic molecular states. Right? And on this side, it's where you have three body forces and so on. The units here, I honestly don't remember. Right? It's just. We typically don't include that potentials that deep, right? But just because we can get away with simple models, right? I use the pairwise potential, the diatomic potential. Well, this part is the short range. This describe, look, if the van der Waals length is about 100, everything that is smaller than 100 means that the particles are in a radius smaller than 100. So that include, I'm inside the two-body well. The particles are going to be very correlated. At distance larger than the van der Waals length, right, I start separating the system. So I see a separation here that describes an atom and a molecule. Right, and so and they are the continuous too. Servas, just.
So you say that you spent most of your effort on calculating that situation, and then you have to go to very large. Do you have any other technical
You know, if you have a finite range potential, right, it's unclear when you're going to be separating from one region to the other. But of course, if I go to 10,000, 20,000, these potentials should agree with analytical theories, right? Although the analytical theories does assume that your interaction is zero range. So if there's any corrections, right, that's not going to be showing there. But it typically works very well if you are very, very large. And in practice, right, we typically calculate these potentials until a couple of times, 10 times the two-body scattering length. Right? If I have a scattering length of 1,000, I calculate the potential to 10,000. And then after that, I use extrapolation formulas. Right? But you have to realize that once you have deep states, you don't have a very good analytical theory for that. You can try to get some approximated form. So we know the power law. So, but, and then we extrapolate these power laws. And so at some point we.
So you know the analytical theory, you know the power law, and you can match that to something which you calculate.
Yeah. So in practice, okay, that's a little more precise of what we do, right? We calculate up to radius large, 10 times larger than the scaffolding. After that, we can extrapolate up to 10 to the 6, let's say.
Uh-huh.
They're typically coupling between, if I have two atom dimer channels, and this dimer is a S-wave dimer, and the other dimer is also S-wave, the coupling between these states are going to be 1 over R. Or if it's, they have the same partial wave, so bound channels with the same in the same vibrational state, rotational state, couples like 1 over R. No, this is an off-diagonal thing, right? It comes from the kinetic energy. Exactly. So that we typically calculate to we couple the as many channels we get converged that the particular observable we want. Okay. Yeah. In principle, if you can solve this with infinite channels, it's going to give you the exact energy. Yeah, there's infinite number of these continuous guys. Well, if you guys allow me, I can move on. Right? I mean, stop me anytime, of course. Seeing if I didn't forget anyone that was raising their hands for a question, you had something. Sorry if I skipped someone. But, well, the question you might ask is, why do we care about free body physics, at least in the context of ultra-cold gases, right? You have a very dilute system, right? And, well, free body processes are the main process that cause losses, right? Because, so it compromises the stability of the gas, right? A process like free body recombination, three particles colliding to form a diatomic state, it can release kinetic energy, right? And this kinetic energy is typically much larger than the trapping potential. So the final product of this collision process would have a kinetic energy that is too large for the trap to be able to hold it. And vibrational relaxation too, right? You have a, in their case, in the experiment, they have. So I'm trying to be consistent. When you see a wiggly thing, that's a Fischer-Baum molecule. So it's very weakly bound. So they can produce those molecules, and they go under relaxation very fast. And both processes can cause losses. So that was the main reason why experiments start worrying about that. But of course, there's more to that. Like the elastic properties are very important. They are going to, in the ultra-cold regime, they are going to tell you how strongly atom-dimer mixture you interact, right? In this case, we know, right, the atom-dimer scattering, which is the analogous of the two-body scattering, right, can go through poles. So atom-dimer mixture can interact both attractively when it's negative or repulsive when it's positive. So that's going to introduce full body correlations to the system. And the same if you have just a pure diatomic mixture, right? The dimer-dimer scattering. Now, because of four body bound states, can also go through poles, right, which enhance the correlation in system. Now, I still didn't even touch on this, right? What is F-MOV physics, right? And that's what is the fundamental physics that it's behind most of this observed F-body effects in ultra-cold gases, right? And in fact, it's kind of a funny story, because F-MOV physics comes from nuclear physics, right? And now they're exploring this in atomic physics. And what the nuclear system has in common to atomic system is the short-range interaction, right? And so, and you can find regimes where it's S-wave dominated. And one way that I try to summarize what is F-MOV physics, this is F-MOV, by the way, is the appearance of a attractive or repulsive three-body interaction, right? It's something that is not described in terms of two of the pairwise. So it's a purely three-body effective interaction that occurs when the scatterland is much large. Now, in nuclear physics, it was always hard to find one situation where you have the system naturally offers you a large scatterland. Right? But in atomic physics, we can actually make that happen. Right? And the free-body, the F-MOV physics controls the interaction, the losses, and the main characteristic of the F-MOV physics is the F-MOV effect. Right, which is this appearance of an infinite number of three-body bound states. You might right away think, well, if you have short-range interactions, how can you have an infinite number of bound states? That's already some awkward thing related with this effect that I hope I will try to make that clear. But maybe more for the chemistry, right, to understand what is this triatomic state. Right. Roughly speaking, right, if you look to a usual three-body triatomic state, if you break one of the bounds, right, the other two particles are still going to be bound. Right. But in an F-MOV state, the scenario is different. If the three particles are bound, right, and you remove one of the bounds, all this thing fall apart. So it's not a typical state, so not a typical triatomic state. Those are what people call the Borromean rings. Right? And people have always been drawing analogy of F-MOV state to a Borromean ring, because you can remove, if you remove one of the rings, the other two rings fall apart. Now, a little bit more physical. But now, of course, using the language of hyperspherical, which was the same language that F-MOV used when he was exploring this problem. Right, I want to show you the three-body potentials and the three-body spectrum when you are changing the scatterland. So when I'm going from here to there, the scatterland is getting large and negative, and then goes to a pole, large and positive, to zero. Right? And what is happening with the three-body potentials? Right? When I, in this figure, the green lines are bound states, three-body bound states, and this one is the Feshbach state. Right? So it goes like 1 over a square, but that's a log scale, so that's why you see a straight line. And this x is a little complicated, but you can think this has been just like 1 over a, okay? So, this is the magnetic field amplitude. This is just to indicate that when you have a small and negative scatterland, this is the kind of potential you should have. And then, if you see now, you understand. I'm changing the scatterland, okay? What happens is that you start to gain some attraction here, all right? And if you increase more, you get more attraction. You can bind a second state. I have this one bound, this other one bound. And then when you go to exactly the pole, you will see that this interaction is actually 1 over r squared. Attractive, So you should have infinite number of bound states. I'm not drawing infinite of bound states here, but that's what this gray area should mean. And then when you go off the resonance, the effect interactions is going to have a shorter range. It typically ranges from the van der Waal length up to the scatter length. So there's a finite range. When you are off unitary, this one of our square interaction holds only up to distance about A. Right? So you start losing these three-body states there. So the first funny thing that you might think here is that if you're coming this way, right, you don't have any two-body state, but still you are able to form infinite number of three-body bound states. If you come the other way, right, you're making the interaction weaker because your diner state is going to become unbound, So on the two-body, you are losing a state, but on the three-body, you are creating an infinite number of states too, right? So in this kind of perspective was one of the reasons why people didn't take that seriously, these predictions, right? So for many years, people tried to disprove and so on, but they only found ways to prove the same effect in a different way, right? So it was really there. But it was, of course, with the cold gases in nuclear physics, this idea was accepted already before the quantum gas was accepted that this phenomenon should exist. There were searches and this and that, but cold gases were the ones that first observed this kind of resonance. And we also have extended this for four particles. There are some experimental observations already for tetramer states. So it's not quite advanced stage right now, especially because that's the key, right? Is the tunability of the scaffolding that the experiments can do very well. And just to mention some properties, which are properties of one of our square, you have geometric scale of energies, and every length scales also have this geometric factor. This guy is about 22.7. In which x? Here? Yeah, this is the van der Waal length.
That's the van der Waal.
Yeah.
So the depth of the gross matter.
Yeah, that's what we found. I mean, what the experiments found, and later we understood. Right? But in principle, right, as you Gaten was saying, right, if I know who is the ground state, if I know this value, I can predict all the others using this geometric scaling. If I know where the first ethmoid state appears here, I can predict where the others are going to appear using this kind of a relationship. So this system has this geometric scaling always. But, so, and that's what actually what I'm going to start talking is the dependence of these observables in terms of a single parameter, what we call the three-body parameter, right? Which I guess for chemistries, that should be the three-body potential, the three-body force with non-pairwise three-body force, right? And that incorporates everything, right? Everything in this theory, we incorporate all this what is happening at short distance in terms of a single parameter, which in principle is unknown, right? But that's where the experiment come and show us something new, right? So there's various experiments running and trying to observe ethmoid states and so on in Innsbruck, Heidelberg, Penn State, Rice, in Israel, in Florence, and in Gila too, right? And if you label this, use this to label where this first ethmoid state appears, right, you see that for all these experiments, they show results about 10, minus 9, minus 10, sometimes minus 8.88, and so on. Once you rescale in terms of the van der Waal length, so that was a really big surprise, Because what we would expect is that this is a completely random number. In a calculation, no, right? It's just because we always thought it can be anything, and even though if you can give me the three-body force, I'm not sure if that would be accurate enough to pin down this, because those things are very, very weakly bound. So 1% in a three-body force would be a completely random on this level of energy, right? So.
I think so.
It's about 10 to 15%.
Well, the variation among them is 10 to 15%.
Yeah.
But the experimental uncertainty on any given number.
Yeah.
Is
less than that.
Less than that.
Yeah.
A few percent.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And well, so of course that got us intrigued. Well, what was happening there, right? And maybe I don't need to go much over this. I just want to speed up a little bit. I was just trying to explain what is this three-body parameter, right? And for that, I was coding this zero. When you assume contact interaction for the particles, the potential acts diverse. So you have what they call the Thomas collapse, but that's a pathology of this model interaction. And typically, people from effective field theory, for instance, they impose what they call the momentum cutoff, right, which is equivalent to put a hard wall here, right? So you get energies that are finite, but the position of the hard wall could affect strongly these energies. And so that's why the three-body parameter always considered as unknown, right? On more real system, right, you would think, oh, you want some smooth potential, which also, the way that you draw it, it would alter the energies. But in reality, right, what happens is something more like this, right? Very complicated. So in this tiny region, you should see all this, and of course, why? Why should we have any universality in this system? And this is, again, just versions of the three-body parameter, right? Those are the experimental observables that could that tells you information about this three-body parameter, which is the energy of the ground state, the FMO of ground state, the position of the force resonance. There's minimum because there's interference effects, and also atom dimer resonance. So there are experimental observables. The one that experiments have been measured is mostly this A minus. So we decided to look at this problem closely, right? We started doing calculations with Lennard-Jones potential. Our idea was to go from one bound state up to 100 bound states, right? And see, and for each one of these cases, calculate the ground state of the FMOV state, the value for the FMOV ground state energy. So it has typically, for Lennard-Jones potential, it's kind of funny. If you have 10 S wave states, you have N square. If you have N S wave bound state, you have N square total number of states at unitarity. All right. But that's why I remember how many bound states there are there. And again, here is typically, we don't have three-body forces, so if I include three-body force, those guys would tend to be much deeper than this, right? But what we found, really, in this region, which is tiny region in this energy spectrum, the potential that holds FMOD states actually have a barrier, right? Those are results with different number of bound states. So for this one, I have one bound state. This one, I have four. In this one, I have 100 bound states. In this, one of these potentials here in the middle, right, all in the middle of this spaghetti, behaves like this, right? They always show this repulsive barrier. And that, for us, was the key, right, of for the explanation, right, why these energies are always the same. Well, because you cannot actually penetrate and probe all these complications. So if you are a very low collision energy, right, you have to face this barrier. Right? If you are on the three-body continuum, you have to tune through this barrier to probe all this complicated physics at short distance. Right? And of course, we went over details. I might actually skip this, right? But that's our physical explanation, because we want to understand why there's that barrier. That's the next question, right? And the way that we understood this picture, right, well, this is just a schematic way of how the geometry of this three particle system is with respect to the hyperangles, right? And if I now show you, this is the angular wave function for the system. So you can see that in this region, right, 5 pi over 3 pi over 3, which are region in the space where two particles are going to be close to each other, right, the wave function is suppressed. So you can be in every configuration other than two on top of each other and the third one far apart. Right? And this is the hyperspherical channel function at fixed hyperradius. Oh, the distance from the center is the amplitude of the wave function. So it's kind of similar to a orbital. And distance from the center gives you the probability. Or this is phi square.
Right. You essentially are saying you're suppressing the two particles coming together. And I've talked to Chris about it a lot, and I'm not sure he understands me or I understand him yet quite on this. Initial thinking about this was that as the van der Waals cliff, you're coming along very slowly, the potential suddenly dives around the van der Waals length, and that's where the very long wave undergoes the quantum reflection off that. But Chris doesn't seem to like that explanation at all. But
that's the explanation we use.
Is that the explanation?
Yeah.
Because
I remember
he's hoping he didn't like that so much. So, but do you like it?
I like it. I think though maybe. And I think we are all, you know, I've seen people. I think we are all talking about the same things.
Okay.
I mean the. Why is it, so? That's what I'm trying to explain here.
Yeah.
So. So, I think we are talking the same things, Paul.
Okay.
I mean, you might tell me after I finish these slides, because again, I still didn't explain why you have this goddamn barrier, right? I'm just showing a wave function and showing there's a suppression of the probability of being there, and then you can ask, well, why you have suppression probability to be there, right? And well, we start thinking. We tried different things, different ideas, like quantum reflection, right? One way the people we thought could be, right, was two particles coming, you see this whole huge cliff, and then would reflect back, right? But we calculate the reflection probability, the reflection coefficient, it's very small, right? So that wouldn't be what it could be causing. And what we turn out, of course, there is a use of related with this cliff.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, it's entirely possible that that simple picture is not correct. And let him go. Let Jose go. Let's see what he says.
Okay. So maybe let me tell you this, Paul. When you look to a two-body system, right? At short distance, I mean, near the minimum of that three-body potential. You can ask, what is the average two-body collision energy in this three-body state. Right? When you calculate this number, it's a very large number. Very large, I mean...
Compared to what? If it's large compared to the Van der Waals energy, then that's right.
No, it's about the Van der Waals energy. But if you calculate the reflection probability, it's small. It's 10% of probability of well, the probability of penetrate is about 90%.
It's more subtle than simple quantum reflection, but it's associated with the sudden transition in the wave function from a long de Broglie wave to a short range kind of very rapidly oscillating wave.
Yeah.
I think we agree on that.
Yes. And the way that I thought, Paul, if you look at a typical two-body wave function, is this, right? And if you use a WKB approximation, it's going to work very well right here. And you can see clearly this 1 over the local K behavior controlling the amplitude of the two-body wave function. So we were thinking mostly that was the most sensible... I mean, that's not a closed problem, right? I don't think we have, that's still open for interpretations. The fact that it is there, right? Our interpretation is that you have this increase of the local velocity, right? Which then, if the local velocity increase the kinetic energy, and the kinetic energy is gonna, it's a positive energy, it's gonna lead to some repulsion, right? So we were kind of comfortable with this interpretation was one that was consistent with many factors. We tried many different things, but at some point it fails to be consistent and so on. This one, in terms of the increase of the local velocity, so you have the two particles coming and they're seeing, you have the kinetic energy start increasing, and the two-body potentials, they start gonna feel this strong kinetic energy effect.
Below the Van der Waals energy, the quantum semi-classical connection breaks down at this point. But there's something definitely interesting happening about the
Van der Waal length.
Something going on with respect to the kinetic energy.
Mm-hmm.
Semi-classically, you think of a local kinetic energy localized at R, that K of L of R. In a certain sense, that's the place where it's not quite right. That amplitude no longer looks like that in this region.
Yeah.
So something's happening with respect to that the kinetic energy is, I don't quite know how to say it. But
yeah, so, and I also want to emphasize.
So you draw this picture with the hyperangular dependence, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and you talk about kinetic energy at the same time. So it doesn't have to do with the fact that they have three parts, but that they have two parts of the system. They have all of a sudden the large gain of kinetic energy. And then this means that the three parts of that would seem to be the goals of their.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. The increase of two-body local velocity is translated in the three-body problem as kinetic energy. The couplings, right, and we know these hyperspherics of the known and the bad couplings are kinetic energy couplings. The couplings are order of magnitude larger than we not all, it's one order of magnitude larger than we usually see, right, for shallow potentials, right? So this is a small hyperradius. It's a 2. I remember it's 2.7 times the Van der Waal length. Small, small-ish.
Hmm?
Factor 2. Yeah. So that's the region where the kinetic energy is going to be large. So this is. To be fair, it's still I'm still waiting someone give a precise answer, right? We do the numerics and we find this. We have a good explanation, right? And I think so far, everyone that have seen these kind of effects turns out to be talking about the same things. But just so to emphasize, if you have a shallow potential, that's the version of the figure of a shallow potential. So you do have a large amplitude of the wave function to be inside the valley. While here, the amplitude to be inside the valley is very small. But, well, again, these are the potentials that I showed before, but now with different potential models, two-body models, this is a hard sphere plus a van der Waal tail. That's the black line. This is this one is a deep Leonard Jones, right, of 100 bound state. This is a set square with at least 8 S wave bound state, and so on. So even when you interchange the model of the interaction, you do get the same kind of potentials. Well, the hard sphere. This hard sphere have no bound state at all. You have 1-0 energy bound state. So the radius of the hard wall, right, I adjust to put a 0 energy bound state. Hard sphere plus a van der Waal tail. I'll have a 0 energy bound state. Right. And then, well, of course, we have to calculate the, well, this is more or less a repetition. And we calculate the energy of the ground state, the FMOV of ground state for all these kind of potentials. Right? And we see this kind of behavior. Like N here is the number of S-wave bound states for that a particular model have. And you see for set square, it's very shallow when you have one bound state. You see this kind of convergence always converging to this. This is a soft wall plus a van der Waal tail and so on. And also we calculated the value of the scatterland where you have a zero energy FMOV state, which is the experimental observable, and that kind of behavior we saw, and those are the experimental data. Right? So there are variations, right? And these variations are related with sometimes we have a weakly bound G wave bound state in the same energy range than a FMOV state, so that perturbs. That's one this case here, right? So there are perturbations on this result, right? But so we typically call to the has the universal this black line here, which is the result for the hard sphere, which is the pure result without any perturbation, right? And of course, here's a list of other people that have been also exploring, right? This is one thing that really has made people curious still to understand what is happening. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter what is happening in the chemistry side. Right? This barrier prevents you to probe where the region where all the chemistry is important. Yeah.
You're at an hour now, so do you think you could?
I can't wrap the.
Can you talk about dipoles in 5 minutes?
Sure. Let me say 5, but probably 50. I'm just kidding.
Our exploration of the experimental free body stuff is. If you do it 15 and 20 minutes, so we can postpone it until tomorrow. But.
I think I can go fast in some points here. Right? Everyone knows that the dipole interaction, right? All this, there's a lot of things happening, people coming with new experiments to create dipolar molecules. That's one kind of potential we use to calculate three dipoles. Right? Those are two-body interactions with dipoles. and all the L states here, there are a couple. L is not a good quantum number, but we typically characterize the interaction in the system in terms of the largest K matrix element. Right? Yeah, the large element of the K matrix. And call that the scatter length or the scattering matrix. And the idea is that we want to explore the three-dipole problem near one of these dipole-dipole interactions. So now I'm talking about a bound state formed by two dipolar molecules. All right. Tuning the dipolar interaction, you can...
And in this case, you mean you've turned on an electric field, so it's
exactly.
The body frame dipole is no longer not giving you a space frame dipole, but you're picking up a little space frame dipole. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're tuning.
Yeah. And my DL here is the dipole length. We like to think in terms of length scales rather than the dipole moment itself. So maybe I should concern, so sometimes it might be confusing how to connect this, but molecule RBK, it can push to regime of a dipole length larger than the van der Waals length, right? Can RBK?
So you're thinking of that scale as an electric field scale, but you're measuring your electric field in terms of the dipole length over van der Waals length.
Yes.
Okay.
Because it turns out the dipole length is an important length scale for the three-body problem. Yes, yeah. So on top of the isotropic Leonard Jones, we have this anisotropy. Which things collapse? Oh, I'm assuming there's non-reactive. Yeah, good point. Yeah, I should say that. There's non-reactive dipoles. So our first question was, would all this F-mod stuff hold for dipoles? We didn't know. It's really not clear for non-dipoles. F-mod is controlled by S-wave scattering and so on. Now, for a dipolar system, L is not conserved, and L is not J, which is the true body angular moment, is not conserved. So there's a lot of things that could conspire against the F-mod effect. But it turns out that it does hold. Right? Those are typical three-body potentials for dipoles. We don't have many two-body bound states here in this calculation. Right? Again, because we know that we can use models. But so these are channel described collisions of three of these dipolar molecules, and we actually don't know the interaction potential between the two dipoles at short distance, but. That's going to be a scalable parameter in the calculations, right? And those are, we were thinking calling this a dipolar dimer, but I'm not entirely sure how to call these states, but it's a two-body state made out of two dipoles. And again, if this figure reminds a lot what I showed before for the three-body parameter discussion, right? In this case, you also have a repulsive barrier. But now, it depends on the dipole length. So this barrier, while for neutral atoms, this barrier is about twice the van der Waals length. Now for dipoles, this barrier can go, this is going to depend on your electric field. You can push this barrier very, very far away. Right? And of course, the energies of the states now are going to depend on the dipole length, not on the van der Waals length anymore. And there's also, of course, so this barrier prevents the system to approach at distance smaller than the dipole length. So that should suppress even more strongly reactions involving three dipoles. Yeah, yeah.
And did you estimate anything at all about the tunneling through that barrier, or are you still not yet?
So we determine some scaling, right? One way to answer this is if you ask, what is the lifetime of one of these three-body states? The lifetime increases, like the dipole length square. So has a, so if you make the dipole interaction stronger, the lifetime increase, which is basically saying that it's getting harder and harder to get through this barrier. That's why this state is long lived.
So if two dipoles that are non-reactive come together, they might not get close together for whatever would happen, or even if they're reactive, they're not reactive. But you could form, so what's the binding energy there? Is that deep enough then so you would release much energy?
No.
Or is that such a shallow potential?
That's very shallow. And you know that the minimum of this potential, the amplitude here, depends.
One dipole energy corresponding to the dipole length. Is that what you mean by 1 - 1 - 2?
I just multiply by the mass and the dipole length square. So it's units of the 1 over m over dipole length square.
Okay, so effectively it's like a.
So this energy scale wouldn't be enough to cause losses.
Okay, I'll catch you later, but I'll put a plug in some numbers and put it in kilohertz or something.
So it's cheap, this is 100 kilohertz.
Pardon?
100 kilohertz, for sure.
100 or under?
Under
a kilohertz, for which the most deep, the minus one level?
Yeah.
For say like a dipole length, for a dipole moment of a Debye or so?
I need to double check to remember.
But it'll depend on the dipole.
Of course. Yeah, but if you start pushing the dipole a couple of times larger than the van der Waal length, the dipole moment, the dipole length, okay. You start getting.
You're saying you can actually make these diamonds, but they might not be terribly lossy in a.
No, and I actually, that's one thing. I think that's a reasonable proposal, to create these dimer states. From recombination, that's what people have done with fermions, right? You sit there on resonance, right? Antibody recombinations don't start create these weakly bound dimers, and that you didn't do nothing, just sit there in a resonance, and that created, because the fermionic system is long lived. In this case, it also tend to be long lived. So maybe I'm gonna get fast to the end. This is just a schematic of the what would be happening if you're passing through many of these dipole-dipole resonances, you start creating F-mod states. So there's this triatomic dipolar state, diatomics here. And because you have this repulsive barrier, we can predict, right, many properties predict where each one of these points here is going to occur depending only on the dipole length, right? And that also translate, I was emphasizing here that some interesting opportunity because this system tend to be long-lived. So if you want to put three dipoles in a trap, and the dipoles are not reactive, of course, you might be able to hold the three dipoles in a trap for a long time. For fermions, three fermionic dipoles, right, we also found a universal triatomic state. There, in the sense that the energy only depends on the dipole length, right? So and it forms an angle with the electric field, right? It has this geometrical form. That's another way to represent that state in terms of probability density, but I don't want to go over this, right? But it's kind of unusual. It's typically three identical fermions is not going to have a universal three-body state. But once you have the dipole interaction, it conspire again to have a universal state.
Single state, not a series.
No, it's just just one single state.
But it's at point two, so it's much closer in than the boson, but there's still a barrier, right? And it doesn't tunnel through the barrier.
Yeah, it does have a barrier. The barrier is slightly smaller. The potential is deeper, like for the same dipole. So it is more deeply bound. Right,
but your scale there's got a 10 squared on it, so it's a is that right? So that's at minus 100 rather than minus 1.
Yeah. If I'm looking to the bosonic system with a fermionic system, the same mass, same dipole length, the fermionic state is going to be 100 times deeper, that's when you get a few hundred kilohertz for typical vendors for the...
Possibly a lossy process.
You cannot, this energy is going to scale with the dipole length. If you made the dipole length larger, this energy is going to be smaller. But you don't probe these states for collisions, right? Well, this that's my actual last slide. Maybe some complicated formulas for the reaction rates, right, for dipoles. So then, if you look here, the most important thing is the scatterland square to the fourth, right? In this eta parameter, it goes to zero when the dipole length goes to zero. It actually goes like one of dl square. Right, and that's the inelastic parameter is what is telling you how much you're doing. So we have this analytical formula that we can use to predict the recombination. And for small dipoles, smaller than the scatter length, right, recombination goes the dipole length to the fourth power. Now, if you now start to study this dipolar dimer colliding with another dimer, you have a linear dependence in the scatterland, but this parameter is going to be very small. So that's standardly typically translating in a small rate. Right? And that's all we want, large rates for formation of dimers and small rates for the relaxation of these dimers. So that's why I think that could be possible to do as a scheme to produce this kind of dimers. Which I...
It'd be interesting to put some real numbers together for one of the molecules.
Yeah. I think I owe you this. But guys, I think that I'm going to stop here. There are some interesting stuff, but maybe some other time. Thanks.